From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
4 years ago, actor and singer Mike Lee moved from South Dakota to New York City to further his career. Like most artists around the globe, the coronavirus has left him with fewer opportunities. Well, at least for the time being. But thanks to a project he started 18 months ago, Lee is releasing his first full-length album called Pick Me Up Cafe. Mike joined Lori to discuss his new release.
Mike, thanks for being with us on In the Moment. Congratulations on the release of Pick Me Up Cafe.
Thank you, Lori, and thanks for having me.
You'll never forget the environment that you released the first album into, will you? Years
no,
from now.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. It will forever kind of be linked to this crisis in my memory, you know.
And I just, you know, 50 years from now, that's it. 50 years ago today, we will look back.
Yeah, exactly.
But what, you know, what are you seeing, you know, like right now that means something? And since we know that we're, you know, living our own history right now, is that changing, you know, the conversations you have about this, the way you think about this album release? Are you thinking about what it will feel like looking back on it from future artistic projects and albums?
Absolutely, yeah, I am. I made a single in March. I had written one of the songs, and I spent a few days working on a second one, and I released them as an A B side single. And I kind of rushed that to have something out and to work on something during this like shutdown. And yeah, that sort of changed like the shape of this project, right? Which was supposed to be like its own debut, you know. And having all of these home shows, like streaming from my living room and all that stuff, definitely has like changed the way that I imagined this album's debut and rollout going, for sure.
Yeah, and I see some of the work people are doing, and I was looking at, you know, we're friends on Facebook, and you know, following stuff that you've posted, and you wrote a song about healthcare, and it reminded me of, you know, Pete Seeger or Arlo Guthrie or, you know, Peter Iero, somebody who writes about something that's happening right now and the pain that people are kind of going through and sits there with a guitar and kind of plays it. And I started thinking about these, you know, these musicians who are more important than ever and then also oddly sidelined in a way where mm-hmm. you have something really relevant to say, but you can only say it in this little box, and that makes it both more effective and less effective at the same time. So how do you kind of, how do you could talk a little bit about that and just this sort of the duality that you're living right now in the world needs this, the world needs art and music, and yet here it is in this little container in some ways.
Right. Yeah. I have more time than ever to play music, but like I should be at clubs in Queens and Brooklyn, you know, playing these songs for the release and, you know, out with other bands and supporting them and supporting each other and doing the community part of music, which is a huge part, you know. I'm spending more time playing music, but it's harder to get it right in front of somebody where this stuff feels immediate. And while this is like a studio album, going into it, we started it with live demos. So, like, I was always aiming for this to be a sort of electric live feeling album, you know, that was meant to be played in clubs and in bars and stuff.
And we would love to have you in the studio sitting here and playing for us as well, because that's just a layer of moment and sound that we usually get. But we are going to play some tracks from the album. And let's start with the title track, Pick Me Up a Cafe. Tell us a little bit about the name of this, because it refers to a specific place for you.
Yeah, well, there is there's a cafe in Chicago. It's in the Roscoe Village in Chicago, and I was on the road there. I was actually supposed to be in Omaha finishing this record, and I got an acting gig. And so I sidelined the record for a few months while I took this acting job in Chicago. And I found this weird all-night kind of offbeat hippie cafe, and it inspired me to write what became sort of the centerpiece of the album. It's kind of the newest song on the record, but yeah. Something about it felt thematic to me. And so I thought maybe it kind of would help tie the other songs together.
And then you get a title and you get cover art and everything sort of takes a kind of, I don't know, right. do you believe in a muse? Do you believe that it kind of just, you know, fall, like, how do you believe that creative process works? Because here's the last one and yet it turns out to be, you know, the engine in so many ways.
Something I learned, I guess, making this whole project is to kind of latch on to an idea and see how far it'll take you, and not try to worry about, you know, pigeonholing it into what you think it should be, but letting the thing take shape on its own. And so when I wrote that song and when I kind of put that song in the context of these other songs, I thought, oh, what if you put it here? How does that change the story of this, like, whole album versus if it's at the beginning or if it's in the middle? Okay, now how does it change the story if that's what the album's called? So this theme is, like, present in all the songs.
Mm, I like that. All right, here's Pick Me Up Cafe. You're listening to Mike Lee on SDPB Radio.
You know anywhere around here that's open? Pie's too sweet and they're sure to burn the eggs. Where the waitress don't like you and you can read it right on her face. I'm looking for a room full of people who won't stay. Down at the pick-me-up cafe, it's a little hideaway below the train. The coffee's dark enough to cover up your shame, so don't be alone. One of the game. That guy in the back, he looks for lovers on the phone. That girl on his arm, she's got a heart that's hard as stone. Kid walking up always comes in on their own. But with a little luck, that's not how they go back home. Down at the pick-me-up cafe, it's a little hideaway below the train. The coffee's dark enough to cover up your shame, so don't be alone. You can be one of the game. Only head on down to the lonely side of town. Down at the pick-me-up cafe, it's a little hideaway below the train. The coffee's dark enough to cover up your shame, so don't be alone, you can be one of the gang.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio, a little moment in sound today with musician Mike Lee. That was the title track from his newly released today, Pick Me Up Cafe. You can find him on Bandcamp and Spotify and Apple iTunes. Mike, you're also a successful actor. You're a singer-songwriter. How do you balance those things, and do they feed on each other and sort of help inform one another, or are they always kind of competing, you know, for what you'd like to give your most energy to right now?
You know, that the answer to that question is always competing with itself in my life, it seems. Since I was about like 15, 16 years old, I had this sense that I would have to choose one eventually. And every time I've tried to say, okay, now I'll focus on music, which is kind of a period I'm in right now, or now I'll go focus on acting. They feed each other in this really wonderful, wonderful way. And the communities are even related. I was playing a show in Queens about maybe 6 months ago, and I was on this bill of kind of Americana country folk musicians. And after the show, I was standing outside on the curb waiting for taxis with all the guys and girls who were playing with me. And we all found out we were all actors, or we were all, you know, we were all painters who moved here from Indiana or Ohio or whatever. And now I kind of thought I was the only country singing actor in all of New York City. And I found out pretty quickly that's not true.
Was that a good feeling for you, that they suddenly feel a connectivity, or was that a feeling of like, oh, dang, I thought I invented this? Like, well, you could kind of go either way in your mind.
kind of, yeah. I mean, you go to an audition and you see 16 of you, and that happened that night to me a little bit.
Cosmic American, when we talk about genre, and you know, you grew up on country and, you know, kind of wanted to reject that and then brought some of that back into your life, and you have these different influences and this sort of word or this term Cosmic American, tell us a little bit about what that means to you.
Yeah, so it goes back to this guy Graham Parsons and the Flying Burrito Brothers, who was this 70s country musician. And he kind of had this idea that folk music and country music and blues music and rock and roll weren't really all that different, and kind of just depended on what radio station would play you and what outfit you wore. And he kind of wanted to get rid of all of that. And so I've always been really attracted to that movement, like mid-60s Beatles records that have a little bit of like Bob Dylan folk influence on them, and like Byrds records and all that stuff that has always kind of been this target I was aiming for. And I couldn't, when I was younger, you're right, I couldn't see through like the country music and see like, oh, like the Beatles are in that, you know, the Beatles listened to Chet Atkins and that's where they learned. And so as I've grown up, I've really understood that connection, and I try to nurture that in what I make.
Let's play another song. This one is Familiar Songs from Pick Me Up Cafe. Anything you want to say about this before we get it started for listeners?
Oh, I don't know. This is sort of one of the more personal moments on the album. I think it kind of speaks for itself.
All right. Familiar Songs by Mike Lee.
Brandishing a coffee cup, singing Maybe I'm Amazed by the Way. She puts puts slippers on when she gets up, stands naked in the sun's first rays. She's gotta work this morning. The way her mind is, she just can't be late. She comes back to bed before telling me it ain't nothing, babe. The plans have changed. I might have begged to stay 10 years ago, but I've learned the art of letting go. No matter how far down I take this road, there's familiar songs everywhere I go. Thousand miles behind me, I was 5 years old, I was staring at a lake. They said, soon enough, you're gonna be on your own. I just couldn't wait to get away. But this country band in Brooklyn does a good, blue eyes crying in the rain. So I can hear Dakota softly singing off the L train. If I knew how it'd be 10 years ago, sometimes I wonder if I would've left home. The world spinning's made my nose grow old. There's familiar songs everywhere I go. Once I knew this man and this tune that he'd heard somewhere before. But we couldn't quite place it, so we listened till it got to the chorus. We sat in perfect silence, swigging beer and just staring at the floor. Sort of drifted right in and hung in the air, lingering before us. Didn't even know the guy 10 years ago, but he was kind in times I needed it most. I'll never know just why he thought he had to go, but I take that song down in my soul.
In this week's Images of the Past, we talked about an educational film that was produced in 1961. The film is a series of interviews and a roundtable discussion featuring South Dakota's then current and still living governors. Matthew Reitzel is the manuscript archivist at the South Dakota State Archives in Pierre. He joined SDPB's Jackie Hendry with more.
Matthew, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Jackie. Thank you. I appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about this film in terms of kind of where it came from and what it was meant to do.
So up at the State Archives in the Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre, once a year we try to go through our film collections and try and find a film to have converted to a digital format and also have conservation work done on it. So in our last go around here, we picked this film out. We also showed it at the History conference last year for the State Historical Society, and basically it was a film that had it kind of served two functions. The first was in 1961, the state of South Dakota was celebrating the 100th year anniversary of Dakota Territory, which was organized in March of 1861. So this part of this film anyway was a way to kind of commemorate the history of the state. And they did that by bringing the governors in and did little interviews with each governor who, as you mentioned, was still alive and able to make it to Sioux Falls at the time. The other part is you mentioned Professor Leonard Genwin from Dakota Wesleyan. He was also chair of the Dakota Territorial Centennial Commission. So he was kind of organized this special class that you could take through Dakota Wesleyan University for 2 semester hours of credit. It included around 31 televised lectures given by Professor Genowin, and you could basically watch it on TV. And you received an outline of the class. There was a book list, different aids you could get. If you registered for the class, there was homework, the 2 quizzes, and also a final exam. And the main textbook they used for this class was Herbert Shell's South Dakota, Its Beginning and Growth. And over 200 students enrolled in this class, and it probably makes it one of the first examples of distance learning in the state of South Dakota. So it ran on TV. You would watch the various episodes, and then you would do work for that, mail it in to get the credit. And one of those episodes, again, was the governor's centennial salute.
Wow. That's so interesting. One of the first examples of distance learning in our state right now, something we really take for granted. Do we have kind of an idea of how that was received? Do we clue in on that by just how many people enrolled in it?
I think the enrollment played a part. I don't know if how many people actually watched it at the time. It was filmed at the Kelleland Television Studios in Sioux Falls, and they ran it on their various affiliates. And I'd assume since it was concerning the governors, they probably played it more regularly than the actual class materials.
Tell us some more about the contents of this particular film that we're talking about. Like, for instance, how are we seeing the professor addressing a class in this kind of unique first foray into distance learning?
Yeah, it is very interesting. He says hello, class, and welcome, class. And there's even a segment. It's 29 minutes long altogether. And there's a section where Professor Genowin asks if any students have a question, and of course they're filming this, but no one's there, and there's kind of this a little awkward pause sort of as they wait. But so the governors that were involved with this project, Governor William McMaster, he just provided a letter. He wasn't at the studios. The other governors who were there were Governor Leslie Jensen, Governor Merrill Q. Sharp, Governor George T. Mickelson, Governor Sigurd Anderson, Governor Joe Foss, Governor Ralph Herseth, and then Governor Archie Gubrud. So each of them, it's kind of split into half, sort of. The first part is basically Professor Genowin introducing each governor, mentioning their years of service. And another, when I was looking at it again here, another thing to point out is back in this time period, a governor would serve a 2-year term, and they could serve up to only 4 years, basically. So it wasn't just a different way of looking at that. But so they would interview each governor, and they would just kind of give a brief description of kind of what they thought was the highlights of their time as being governor. And then they would go through each governor in order. And then the second part is kind of like a round table session, sort of. And Governor Genowin is just asking different governors different questions, and sometimes they feed off each other's answers and things like that. So it's just it's one thing to see at the State Archives we have a number of photographs and a number of photographs of governors, so it's one thing to see a photograph of somebody, but then to see them now actually talking and they're being filmed and you can see them, it's just kind of a very interesting thing from my perspective anyway, to see the voice and the face of a talking live governor. So we were very glad that they did this back in 1961 during the centennial, and that we were able to get it converted to a digital format.
Yeah, and I'd agree with you. It's really interesting. Folks, if you're listening, you can find that blog on our website, sdpb.org, and we have some video clips on that post where you can see bits of this program that aired. And I know we have some audio clips that we want to play through today. So I want to start with, we have a clip from former Governor Leslie Jensen, who his term started in, I believe, 1937, the farthest back of the governors that were able to appear in this program. So we'll start with this clip from former Governor Leslie Jensen.
I cannot help but feel that it fell to my lot to be governor of South Dakota in the low point. drought, a vicious circle, 7 years of recurring drought, had made our people despondent. And I give great credit to the legislative session of 37 that enabled South Dakota to inaugurate a road program. Other states and cross-nation travelers were detouring South Dakota, much to our disadvantage. Another thing that I view with considerable importance is the fact that that legislative session of 37 revamped the tax program and put some real underpinning under the old age assistance that closed up most of the so-called poor farms in the state of South Dakota. I do think that at that low period, our people were discouraged and many people were selling South Dakota short. The trend has been generally up from that point on. And I think that we have every reason. Nothing was ever wrong with South Dakota except when nature took hold and we had those droughts, which I hope we will never, never have again.
What I appreciate about that clip, you hear kind of that pride and grit of facing this natural disaster at the time that he came into office. Matthew Reitzel, what do you take away from that clip in particular about Leslie Jensen and his administration?
Yeah, as you noted, it's a great example of, even though it's a short clip, you can tell a lot how the Depression affected South Dakotans and how, you know, him as governor and also his work with legislators had to come together and to figure stuff out. So, and that reference to the legislature, you also see that in other governor clips as well.
Hmm. We've got another clip from former Governor Merrill Sharp, a governor during the World War II years. Here's a clip from former Governor Sharp.
My term of office is from the years 1943 to 47, and I've always felt fortunate that I was privileged to have a part in one of the most momentous things that has ever happened in South Dakota history, and which is now shedding its benefits all over our state and is destined to shed them for generations to come, and that was the Empire Building Missouri River development, which we were enabled to get through Congress with the help of the governors of the other 10 basin states and the congressional delegations and people generally working in that year, and President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed it into law in 1944. That has simply changed the economic and sociology of the state to an extent that I can't go into detail about. However, to accompany that, it was necessary that we have another thing, and that was the formation of the what is now the Natural Resources Commission of the state. That was inaugurated during my term of office and supported with a little appropriation of $15,000. George Mickelson, who followed me as governor, thought the idea good and expanded it and developed and improved it and got it supported with an appropriation of $65,000. And it still works under different names for you in developing the state to the very best possibilities in harmony with this Missouri River development. One of the interesting things that happened during my term of office was for the first time when the Japanese balloons commenced falling in South Dakota. I couldn't believe that it was true that they could float those balloons across, but when the motor patrolmen and others commenced bringing them in and farmers commenced to catching them out and tying them to the fences, we knew that they were coming from Japan. And that was an interesting feature of the war.
So this is before my time and my expertise as far as South Dakota history is concerned, but coming straight out of that bite, tell us about those balloons that former Governor Sharp is talking about.
Yeah, there's actually, you can see one in the museum of the Cultural Heritage Center here in Pierre, but they were basically balloons. They had bombs on them. The Japanese put them into the upper stratosphere and just sent them out east, I guess. And some of them did reach South Dakota. So yeah, again, just representing a certain time period. And one important thing I want to note with Sharp, he was the first one to mention it, but each governor going forward now, when they give their talk about the highlights of their administration and what people want to remember them for, each one of them mentioned Missouri River development. That just shows the importance of the Missouri River, and Sharp mentioned it in his talk. each governor mentions it until you get to Governor Archie Goobrud. And then he then makes the switch to, now we have all this, you know, the river and these resources, and now we have to, he mentions, you know, people have to go out and see South Dakota and tell their friends to come to South Dakota. So you make that switch from development to getting people to come to South Dakota, which is kind of the origins of tourism in South Dakota, recreational tourism. And a lot of that was involved with the Missouri River.
Wow. And speaking of George T. Mickelson, we have a bite here talking about, again, that development program. But I want to skip ahead just a little bit because I recognize the name Joe Foss, again, before my time, don't know a ton about him. So I want to cue up this bite from former Governor Joe Foss and take a listen.
We concentrated on bringing new industry and expanding that we had in the area so that we would have a diversified economy. And we also concentrated on improving and building a new transportation network through our highways, north and south and east and west across the state. This, of course, fitted into the program that the great previous governors had already put underway, full speed ahead, Missouri River development. And, of course, Missouri River development will be with us for years to come, and the benefits will be reaped by all of the citizens, not only in the state, but the United States. On top of that, we tried to improve all of our institutions and get a lot more done so that it would benefit more people, a better job would be accomplished.
So tell us a little bit about Joe Foss. He was governor kind of the mid to late 50s, known for a colorful personality. What do we know about Joe Foss from this program?
Yeah, and Foss was also a World War II hero. And one of the things that wasn't in the segment you ran, but he really starts out with talking about the people of South Dakota, working with different individuals traveling throughout the state. You could just tell he almost enjoyed doing that. You know, that was like a part where he would talk with people. And I think it's something as governor he like took with him, I guess, when his term was done.
Yeah, we have a fun little group roundtable clip pointing out there's one person here that's a little different than the others, former Governor Herseth, the only Democrat in the room. We have a clip of that roundtable discussion right here.
Well, here we are, class. This is what we said. We said we'd get all these governors around one table at one time so you can see all of them. And I'm going to start, you know, when we saw the governors individually, I singled out one man. And I called him a Democrat just because he's the only Democrat in the bunch. Now, that's Governor Herseth over here, and I'd like to ask these Republicans here what we're going to do with this Democrat. Joe, what do you think about it?
Let him talk. He'll get himself in trouble then.
All right, Ralph, go ahead now.
Well, it'll be the first time if I do get in trouble. I think we have a little unbalanced line here to the left, if I may say so, but I never object to giving the opposition a little advantage in the way of odds. In fact, I'd much rather give than to take. That's a part of my philosophy. I think this is a wonderful idea to get these past governors and the present governor together, Leonard, for the purpose of promoting and getting this centennial off to a flying start. And I had a conversation with Governor Guy just yesterday of North Dakota, and he said, count on us 100% all the way to helping this Dakota Centennial.
Well, there's just something fun about listening to some good old-fashioned ribbing, even back then. But and you hear a bit the beginning of that clip, Professor Jen Wynn, like you said, addressing the class, watching on TV and everything. So tell us a little bit about this clip and the dynamic that we see getting all these governors together.
It's just interesting to see. There haven't been many Democratic governors of South Dakota. So fortunately, Herseth fit into this time period of the centennial. But it's always just kind of interesting to watch.
what happens thousands of miles away does affect our lives. Example being COVID-19, which is said to have originated in a Chinese city that many of us had, well, never even heard of. Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and his new book is called The World, A Brief Introduction. In it, he reminds us globalization is more than a policy, it's a reality. He joined SDPB's Jackie Hendry for this discussion.
Richard Haass, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for taking time to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, The World, just a small project that you undertook, and in your preface, and in your preface, you talk about kind of why this became an important project to you, and it was a pretty good illustration for me as a fairly recent college student. And I wonder if you can share that story for us now. How did you start this?
Sure, it all started on a fishing trip of all things, and I was with this young man who was about to become a senior at one of the world's great universities, Stanford. Don't mean to pick on Stanford, but that was the fact. He was a major in computer sciences. And I said, well, I'm curious, what is it you study when you're not studying code and about computers? I said, for example, how much history have you had a chance to study? He said, actually, none. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Well, what about economics? Not too much of that either. And what about politics? And the same answer. And what I clearly deduced was this very bright young man was going to graduate from Stanford and be totally unprepared for the world he was going to enter and to essentially to be a citizen. He would know everything there was to know about computers, but not a lot else. And the more I looked into it, he was not unique, that this was increasingly true of students from other universities and colleges, obviously true of kids from getting out of high school where these courses aren't even offered. And that what we had increasingly on our hands was a society of Americans who were not globally literate, who didn't have who did not understand the fundamentals of why the world mattered, how it affected their lives, how it worked. And as a result, they weren't in a position to either be informed citizens, knowing who to vote for, knowing how to keep elected officials, representatives to account, and wouldn't necessarily be in the best position to make decisions affecting their own lives. For example, a young person graduating, should I go into the intelligence community, the foreign service, the military, or if I'm working at a factory, should I support the president or oppose the president when he favors introducing tariffs against this country? And it became clear to me that most Americans just didn't have the foundation they needed to make informed choices. And what I thought I would do is produce a book to help them do just that.
You start, part one of this book is sort of the essential history of the world. Chapter one, just a few hundred years between the 30 Years' War to the outbreak of World War I. Tell us, I'm fascinated in this project just because how do you even start? Where do you even begin with a situation like this? How did you decide, I'm going to start in 1618 for the historical context of globalization?
Well, the process was I spent a lot of time walking around Central Park, and that's how I write. I think a lot before I sit down at the keyboard. Choosing that moment, there's some method to my madness. if you go back to that period of history, that's essentially the birth of the world that's recognizable in terms of our own. That's when you first had the emergence of large, powerful countries, and they began to dominate, to use the cliche, the chessboard of the world at the time. And you came up with ideas like sovereignty, such as force in principle should not be used to invade other countries. What goes on within a country is its business alone. And these are some of the building blocks that we are still living with. So I thought this was as good a place as any to explain how we got to where we are.
When you're piecing together these chunks of history, and obviously trying to keep it, it's a brief history, a brief introduction. Talk us through, you mentioned walking through Central Park. What was the editing process like for this? Did you start with something enormous and then really had to shave it down, or what was your approach?
No, the hardest thing was to think about what needed to go into it. So pretty quickly I scoped out that I thought people needed to know some history, needed to have an introduction into the world's regions, the six dominant regions of the world. Then I thought, given where we are at this moment in history, well, essentially they understood global challenges, the various forms that globalization takes, because that's so powerful a force in this day and age. Then lastly was kind of what else do you need to know to understand how the world works? And I came up with some ideas and some things that affect almost how to look at the world, to give people a bottom line, how to understand it. But the hardest thing, again, was making it accessible, and it forced me to really think through a lot that stuff I thought I really knew about turns out I didn't, because in order to write about it clearly, you really got to own it and know it. Mm-hmm. And then the other was obviously what could be left out. So a writer once said about other writers that his best friend is his waste paper basket, and it meant getting rid of stuff that was really not essential. And that's just shorter, less sometimes is more as a writer. It's just always hard for any writer to let go of what he or she has written.
Right. Tell us maybe a little bit of some of those areas that you thought you had a firm grasp on and then discovered, I need to consider this a little more before I can write about it.
My background is more in history, so some of the economic chapters, like there's a chapter about trade, and trade has obviously become a very politicized and politically loaded debate in this country. And to really break it down and say, okay, here's the concept of trade, and here's all the different ways that trade can go off the rails, that trade can be disrupted and can be imbalanced, somehow influenced, and here's all the things we have to look out for. Well, it ended up being a really, really long list. It was one of those, the more I looked into it, the more there was to see. Mm. So I think, my own background, I only took a few economics courses when I was a student, and that was 400 years ago. And it just forced me to get, again, more up to speed on that. And also, I don't know each part of the world equally. Most of my background, if you think about American foreign policy, is on the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. My background in Latin America and Africa is not nearly as strong. So it forced me, again, to read into it, to get up to speed on it, to speak to different experts. And I had experts in each issue, each part of the world, each issue, read each individual bit. So people who have spent 10, 20, 30 years working on one subject, I would make sure that this passed muster, that even though I'm writing for a general audience, it still had to be accurate.
Right. Towards the end of the book, you start talking about some of the biggest challenges we face in this globalized situation that we're in right now. We have a list here from terrorism and counterterrorism to climate change to cybersecurity and all sorts of things that we're looking at now in this globalized reality that we're in. Talk a little bit about breaking out those key challenges. What are you looking to determine those?
Well, as a group, there are many ways what distinguishes this moment in time. Mm. We've always had challenges over the last few hundred years, going back to the early 17th century, where we began our conversation of rising powers, of conflict between countries. That's the traditional stuff of international relations. In the last century, we had two world wars and a Cold War. Now we have angry Russia. We have a rising China. We have a North Korea with the nuclear weapons. This is the traditional thing. What I thought marked this era of history is you had all the traditional stuff, and then on top of that, you had this whole overlay of all these new global issues, things like climate change, things like pandemics, things like terrorism, the kind of thing we saw in 9/11, these vast flows of things around the world that makes up globalization. So I thought what made this 21st century so interesting is you have all the old stuff as well now as all the new stuff, and that's what makes the inbox so crowded and so complicated.
Mm-hmm. I was intrigued, but you have a table in this book talking about the speed of information traveling across the world. I'm going to forget the exact number, but something like a month to 2 months for the Declaration of Independence, news of that to reach England. And then a few hundred years later, former President Obama tweets the Pope and anyone in the world can see it in about an instant.
Exactly. It's that to me is so interesting that you have so many more sources of information traveling at such greater speed. It's one of the reasons this is a tough period of history. It's hard to keep up. It's hard not to get overwhelmed. It's hard to manage it if you're in a position of a policy, of responsibility. Just keeping up and the pace of change and the pace of action, reaction.
Right.
The world never sleeps, literally, and that's become much more difficult.
Hmm. I was interested in this number. It's fairly early in the book, but I'm noticing that we're seeing huge rises in rates of both international tourism and international trade in the last 20 to 30 years. That coupled with just the speed of travel and the speed of information really seems to highlight a need for just the average person, not just an advisor in a presidential situation, but for the average person to really understand a global context. What are you hearing from folks who are reading this? What are their key takeaways?
Well, so far so good. I mean, it's off to a really, really good start. And what people are I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. Really good that you're doing this because, again, you know, in 6 months or whatever, we're going to have the option of voting. And I really want people not just to vote, but to be informed voters.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to deal in the meantime with this pandemic. We have choices to be made to make, and we've got to decide what policies we support or not. And then people have to make career, you know, all these new graduates that we're rightly celebrating. Well, what should they do?
Mm-hmm.
Should they go to school afterwards? Should they join the military? Should they join the Foreign Service? Should they go work for a manufacturing company? Will that company be able to produce those things in 5 or 10 years, sell them to overseas markets? We only represent in this country 4% of the people in the world. We've got to sell abroad. So I just think it's, you know, there's a lot in here that people just need to know about to essentially protect their own interests. I don't want people to go through what they're going to have to experience. What we're all going through now is a perfect example. I almost don't want them to go through it unarmed. I want to give them some of the tools they're going to need so they can better look out for their own interests.
Hmm. You mentioned most of your experience being in history. I'm normally our education reporter, so I think about these issues in higher education and moves towards fewer liberal arts courses, fewer soft courses, as they say, and more of that. But
yeah.
What I don't want to put words in your mouth, sir, but what I'm hearing is an argument perhaps for that context. Why do you open this with history? Why is that so important to you?
100%, because that's, to me, the single most important thing you can have in your background. Look, I want people to have the basic tools, critical thinking, writing, speaking, teamwork. I get that.
Hmm.
But then substantively, yes, I want people to understand history. I want them to understand in this country some of our political tradition. Democracy is not something that continues to thrive on autopilot. We need to make sure that Americans understand why democracy is good and what it takes to keep it strong. All the international things we've been talking about, for the last few minutes, I want people to better appreciate. So, yeah, I'm a great believer that education at the high school and college level should include a real liberal arts education. And you can learn a lot of the specifics of your job on the job,
mm-hmm.
and you can learn, and a lot of those specifics are going to change. Now, think about it. If someone's now 20 years old, over the next 50 years, which will track their career, things are going to change, you know, any number of times. They're going to probably have 20 different jobs. So specific things for jobs they can pick up. What I want them to get is the foundation about their country and about the world. And that, I think, actually, if I were a parent, I would insist or work to insist that a high school or college made sure that was part of the education. If I were an employer, I would want to know that a person I was hiring had some general understanding of the world, since that's where most of the markets are. So, yeah, I would hope that our educational system would not get so caught up with the latest technical fad and instead would think about underlying issues that will actually serve a person well through his or her life.
And in lieu of that, here's a book to get you started, maybe.
Hopefully.
Yeah. In just the couple minutes that we have left, I wonder if you can talk to us just a little bit about what your biggest takeaway, you have your hope for takeaway, your reason behind doing this book, you have your own experiences and your historical knowledge and professionally, but what was your biggest takeaway from the process of putting together a book like this?
Well, besides the areas I didn't know as much as I should know, it reinforces my principal take for my life, which is I've been lucky enough. I've worked for 4 different presidents. Carter, Reagan, Bush, and Bush. And I've been studying these issues when I haven't been in government. And it reinforces my sense of how little is inevitable, how little is baked into the cake, that history can go in lots of different ways, for better and for worse. And so that's, so if you're an optimist, you'd see the potential in things to have it go for better. If you're a pessimist, you'd see just the opposite, and you'd see how it often doesn't turn out well. But look at the last 70, 75 years. They've been amazingly good, but there's been no great power conflict. The average person now who is living 20, 25 years longer than they would have lived if they had been born 75 years ago around the world. The standards of living are incomparably higher. New technologies have really improved the quality of our lives. So things can get better, but they don't automatically get better. And the more I study these issues, the more I take away the idea that how much individuals and specific decisions matter. This pandemic was coming here because of some bad decisions made in China, but then how we responded to it, well, some of those bad decisions we own. And that, to me, is the lesson that something, again, globalization is the reality, is unavoidable, but how we respond to it, I continue to be struck by the range of choice and the consequences of those choices.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.